Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC, and if cash is king, payment apps are the revolution. Watch out, cash. You may want to start your escape to the countryside disguised as a peasant, because new technologies are making the convenience of living cash-free a reality. According to some research, almost half of us walk around with less than $20 in our pockets, and there are so many other ways to pay, right? A dozen and counting, including mobile wallets and store-branded payment apps, and, of course, old-fashioned credit and debit cards. But according to my next guest, the benefits of going cashless can come with a number of potential security and privacy trade-offs, which aren't immediately obvious and may also cost you. Jeff Bliskell is senior editor at Consumer Reports and is the author of the recent article, Cashing Out: New Technologies Are Making the Convenience of Living Cash-Free a Reality. Jeff, thanks for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Well, living in the city completely cashless is still almost impossible unless you want to spend a minimum of $5 every time you go into a bodega. So how close are we to no cash?
Well, actually, we are quite close because if you think about it, credit cards and debit cards are also cashless. A smaller, you know, a rising amount is these mobile wallets like Apple Pay and Android Pay. So they're still trying to gain ground because, as you mentioned, not everybody accepts those, and you do have some minimums there. But about 14% of the volume, only about 14% of the volume of our expenditures is in cash now. That's according to the latest data. So there's, you know, we're paying lots of other ways. And if you think, if you include online bill pay, people are doing that more, so you're not writing checks. You know, it's gaining traction. We're at a tipping point, according to the experts.
And Venmo is so popular, it's become a verb. People say, I'll Venmo you. Like, I'll Google
right.
that. It's so easy. But I guess one of the big questions you're raising is it really secure? So what are the security risks for a payment app like Venmo?
Well, certainly, you know, there are some security risks, obviously, if it gets hacked. And cyber criminals are relentless, so that's always going to be a risk out there, and it can put you at risk. But with Venmo, if you're connected to – generally, if you use an underlying credit card, and a lot of these cashless payment methods use an underlying credit card or debit card, you will have the same protections. So if you take mobile wallets, for example, Apple Pay, you load on a credit card. If something happens, somebody hacks in or somebody, you know, intercept. Now, it's more difficult with the technology. It's actually better than a credit card, a plastic credit card, because there are built-in additional security features such as encryption and fingerprint. You know, your wallet will work unless you use your fingerprint to make it work. But if all that fails, you still have your consumer protections for credit cards. So if unauthorized charges, you're not going to pay for them.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, have you gone cashless? To what degree have you gone cashless? What's your preferred method of payment other than Big Green? Do you have questions for my guest, Jeff Bliskell, senior editor at Consumer Reports? He wrote the recent article, Cashing Out, New Technologies Are Making the Convenience of Living Cash-Free a Reality. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And you're right, one of the biggest privacy concerns is unanticipated uses of your data, because privacy policies tend to give their authors broad permission for uses that may not even exist yet. What do you have in mind in particular?
Well, you know, so at the moment, the biggest threat, quote unquote, is that you will get targeted advertising. So if you're the stuff that you buy with your mobile wallet, it may incorporate, they may include information about your Google searches and such. So what the idea of that is, you're looking around for stereo headsets. So you must be in the market for that. You know, you're searching for that. You must be in the market for that. And you went to a store and you bought something, you know, related to stereo headsets. And so you're going to start receiving ads for that. That's not really that huge a threat. The more troubling one or the concerning one may be down the line. And again, because these privacy, you know, you sign these privacy agreements, or you don't sign them, you agree to them by using the service, mm-hmm. and they're very open-ended. So, for example, you know, how will this affect your insurance rates? If it's suddenly found that you're out partying and gambling a lot, or you know, going to bars, have a lot of charges on bars and such, maybe that could lead to someone cobbling together and developing an algorithm that suddenly says, aha, this guy, you know, we'd better raise his insurance rates. So that's kind of the things where you don't expect. And then, of course, with everything exposed to, the government spying on us with the phone service. And I mean, ultimately, the government has access to all these records. So that's another concern out there. But again, at the moment, it's just marketing things, and people are kind of like, "Oh, that's pretty harmless," but it can be not harmless.
Let me take a caller because I think Aaron in Pine Bush wants to amplify what you just said about the government. Aaron, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yeah. Hi. I work in an industry where tips and cash are wonderful, and help me live day to day. And I just feel if we were to totally go cashless, not only would Uncle Sam know every dealing that we know, and if anybody who works in the service industry, if we were to be completely honest, and if they know every single penny that we made, we really wouldn't be able to survive as a service.
So you mean the best reason for continuing a cash economy is tax evasion?
Not necessarily, but it's also a way, I'm able to kind of pass a better price on to the customer if I have a cash, knowing that I'm uh-huh. not going to be killed with taxes myself. I mean, I just feel like it almost wouldn't work. I've worked in places, whether you're doing construction, whether you're a hair salon, if you don't have cash and you're doing a service, unless you're selling a product and that's what you can do because that's where you can jack up your prices.
Right.
But if you're just a strictly service business, it's really hard to kind of do everything, I guess, by the book. And whether you want to call it tax evasion or whatnot, or having Uncle Sam know every little thing possible so they can squeeze every little penny out of you, I don't always think that's, the best idea.
Right. Some people might call it tax evasion. Donald Trump, we learned last night, would call it smart. But,
but
Jeff, what about that? Yeah. And Aaron is suggesting a few things there. One is that the cashless economy is actually going to make things more expensive.
Yeah, well, I do think she's right on the right track about just kind of the freedom, if you will, that we have. You know, I mean, if I got a speeding ticket for every time I went over the speed limit, I'd probably have 100 speeding tickets, right? Because as you drive, sometimes you go, it's 35, I'm going 40, whatever. What she's talking about there, I think, is it allows for this kind of perfect surveillance of you and, every little thing, and there's no freedom and there's no, cutting some slack here and there. I think that is a concern, and there is an underground economy in the U.S., and one of the reasons people don't want to go, one of the reasons people pay in cash is because they're doing something illegal or they're buying something that they don't want people to know about.
Right.
So this is something that has to be balanced, I guess, because people want their privacy, and we want our freedom. You know, we don't want the government, you know, in our looking over our shoulder every single thing we do.
Aaron, thanks. Call us again. Zane in Maplewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Zane.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
A quick comment with the caveat that I've got a three-year-old in the background, so I may have to take off any second. But I've been pleasantly surprised with using Samsung Pay. I don't believe your caller mentioned that on system. You can use it at any credit card swipe. It has some technology in it that broadcasts it your information right into any Magstrip and reader, and it's been great. I've been saved a bunch of times forgetting my wallet in the car or anything like that. I've been using it for probably over a year, and I've only encountered one machine ever that wouldn't take it. So that's about all I got. I'm going to take my comment.
Zane, thanks a lot.
I can give you more detail on that. We do mention Samsung Pay in there. Apple Pay and Android Pay work on something called near-field communications technology, which is like a radio. There has to be a specific reader that can transmit and send these signals back and forth with the phone. Samsung Pay, so that about 3 million merchants in the U.S. have that technology now. So you could use your Apple Pay in about 3 million merchants, physical stores. Samsung Pay has that technology, plus they have built into the phone a technology that allows the phone to communicate with the Magstripe. When you swipe the card through the Magstripe reader, that's a little bit different technology. It has encryption and such, so it's secure. But it allows Samsung Pay to communicate with it's usable now at about 10 million retailers. So it's more widely available.
Stephanie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stephanie.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I may sound both old and old-fashioned with my questions and comments, but when I hear these things, I can't help but wonder about two things. One, what happens when, if and as the electrical grid goes down, as it did with September 11th and then the blackout, 6-7 months mm-hmm. later? It was a hot mess. I was there. I lived in Brooklyn. That's one thing. The second thing is, on the heels of, the discovery a year and a half later, whatever, that 500 million Yahoo email users got hacked, what if these systems get hacked? So when I hear these things, I say, hey, wait a minute. Great. It's convenient when it's convenient. It's when it's working.
And then
but
it's a disaster when these
–
and Stephanie, I'm going to cut you off only because we have a minute left in the show and I want Jeff to be able to answer your really good questions. Jeff, go ahead.
Yes, and I don't think cash is ever going to completely go away because of exactly that. Another problem is what happens when your phone runs out of electricity, right? Your battery dies. You can't use it. So I think people will always need to have cash, and she's exactly right. In terms of when there's a hurricane, the Federal Reserve gets a big jump in from the banks at ordering cash because people go to the ATM and they want to have cash on hand. So cash is a very comforting thing to have in your pocket.
Well, it looks like we're headed for a world in which the big debate will be whether Harriet Tubman or Andrew Jackson should appear on the Venmo homepage. We thank Jeff Bliskell, senior editor at Consumer Reports, author of the article Cashing Out, New Technologies Are Making the Convenience of Living Cash-Free a Reality. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
WNYC, and as many of you know, a cell phone video was released on Friday, recorded by Rakia Scott, the wife of Keith Lamont Scott, who was fatally shot by Charlotte police. In the video, you can hear her screaming, "He has TBI, or traumatic brain injury." Listen.
Trust God. He doesn't have a gun. He has a TBI. He's not going to do anything to you guys. He just took his medicine.
Though the case is still open, some are speculating that Scott's traumatic brain injury could have meant he did not understand the commands police were giving him moments before they shot him dead. Mental health issues are a factor in about 25% of fatal police shootings, according to a Washington Post database that tracks such incidents nationwide. Just yesterday, police in the San Diego, California suburb of El Cajon shot and killed an unarmed African American after his sister called 911 to report her brother was having a mental health emergency. If it turns out he was suffering from mental illness, he would be the 173rd person in the database where such issues were reported this year. My guest now is Diane Gilmorris, and this really hits close to home for her. She has two black teenage sons who are autistic, and she's been thinking about what would happen if her sons interacted with police officers. How would the situation be handled? You may have heard Diane on the WNYC podcast Death, Sex, and Money last year, where she talked about raising her two autistic sons, Kenny and Theo, and she's the guest host of the current episode of Death, Sex, and Money, where she talks about her concerns about her son's interactions with the police. Diane, thank you so much for coming on live with us on WNYC today. Hi. Diane, can you hear me? Well, either she can't hear me, or I can't hear her, or both. But if you can hear the... Now? Oh, now we've got you. Hi there. Hi.
I'm sorry. Somehow I got muted. my mistake.
Sure. So for those listeners at home who maybe haven't heard you either time on Death, Sex, and Money, can you describe your family? How old are your sons now, and maybe what's a typical day like for them and you?
Well, my boys are Kenny and Theo. Kenny is 17. Theo is 15. You know, the typical day starts at 6:30 or often a little earlier because Theo has a sign in his room that says, get up time is 6:30. So don't come out of your room before then. But we can usually hear him talking to himself and reciting Sesame Street scripts, sometimes as early as 5. They go to school right now. Kenny only goes to school part-time because he just has a lot of anxiety issues. They're great kids. They have a lot of challenges. They're what you would call low verbal. They can tell you what they want, but they can't tell you how their day was or give you an opinion on, necessarily express an opinion on what happened today or something like that.
In the video of Rakia Scott, and obviously every individual is different and every situation is different, but in the full video, she's trying to get the police not to shoot him, as we heard, and she's also trying to get him not to do something. It's unclear, but she's saying, Keith, don't do it. Is that exactly the kind of position you fear that you might wind up in with one of your sons?
My concern tends to be we work very hard. We've been working very hard for years to increase the boys' ability to be independent. And like my big nightmare is that I finally get them to the point where they can be independent, to the point where maybe they can take the bus to a job on their own. But then somebody misinterprets their behaviors. And there's not somebody there to intervene. I mean, certainly having somebody there to intervene doesn't seem to help because, you know, in Charlotte and in San Diego, people were there trying to explain to the police what was happening and, you know, were not being listened to. You look down in Florida where there was a caregiver with an autistic man and the police shot the caregiver for reasons that nobody can apparently seem to understand. Absolutely. I mean, there are certain, it's so much about interpretation. It's so much about assigning a motive to behavior, that you or I might look at somebody and think that the reason they're acting this way is because they're on drugs or they're trying to be aggressive or they're refusing to comply because they're purposely being belligerent. And, you know, a lot of these cases, none of those things are true, and it certainly wouldn't be true in the case of my children. But the reality is, if a cop told my son to put his hands up or you know, freeze, I have no, I really don't know how he would react if the odds are neither of them would hear that, because it's almost like they don't hear people they don't know, which is, you know, kind of unusual, even though somebody is talking to them. If they don't know that person, it's almost like the communication, they don't process it.
In your piece, you talked to Maria Caldwell, whose son, Marcus Abrams, was injured during a confrontation with Metro Transit officers in St. Paul last year. Here's a clip of Maria describing seeing her son after the incident. The police didn't contact her, and she found out from a neighbor who happened to see the police interaction.
Actually, a neighbor that was driving down the street is the one who called me. No one ever called me. No one ever contacted me. While he did eventually go to the hospital, they wouldn't even let me see him for 4 hours. The Metro Transit police wouldn't let me see him in the hospital for 4 hours.
And then once you saw him, what was your reaction?
I was ready to take a vengeance for my son, to say it nicely. I was just devastated and crying, and he had a busted head, busted lip. He had choke marks on his neck. He had what they told me was an impression of maybe something pressing down on his neck other than the arm or hand. He was beat up like he had got hit by the train and survived.
Wow. And so, yeah. Diane, you talk in the piece about how a lot of the autistic children we see portrayed in the media are white, and that people don't associate being black and having autism. Is that relevant?
Oh, God, yes, I think so. You know, I just don't think people make that assumption when they meet someone. You know, one of the things I talk about in the podcast is that things have changed over the years regarding kind of the looks I get from people when my sons are having an issue. When they were little, you know, it was like, okay, well, this is a kid, he's acting out. Okay, fine. You know, now they're essentially, you know, grown men. I mean, Kenny's about 5'8", 5'9". And if they're having an issue, you know, there's no guarantee that anybody's going to make the assumption that this is an autistic person. There's I think, a higher likelihood that people will make the assumption that this is a person who's on drugs. If Theo is walking around talking to himself, which he does a lot, you know, is somebody going to assume that this person is a person with a disability, or are they going to say, this is a person on crack and I can't assume that they're not going to do something just completely outrageous and violent, you know, in the next minute. So, I think, because I just don't think that people see it. I mean, you know, we have this whole trend right now where, you know, we have lots of, you know, celebrities who are saying that they have autism or whatever. And I don't know that it's helpful in really helping people understand that yes, there is a huge spectrum, but some of the people on the spectrum really have pretty significant disabilities that come with that diagnosis.
And one of the people who you interview in this Death, Sex, and Money podcast, who's kind of a hero of the piece, and we don't have time to play him here, people, you'll just have to listen to DSM, is police officer Robert Zink, who founded the St. Paul CARE, Cops Autism Response Education Project, and has two autistic boys of his own. And one thing that Officer Zink said to you was that one of the problems with police work is our standard response to things generally has the inverse reaction with those on the spectrum.
Yeah.
What's an example of that?
Well, you know, one of the challenges that I have as a parent, for example, is that my son Theo cannot handle the idea that somebody is angry at him. So if he does something that he's not supposed to do, and I yell at him for that, he then completely flies off the handle. Like, that is just more than he can take. So I can only imagine in a situation
that's
where
that's all teenagers, by the way, but that's another show.
Yeah, right. Though that might be true, but usually at our house that ends up, you know, that can end up with a hole in the wall.
Yeah.
And it makes it very hard to discipline a child who you realize you're pushing them over the edge. Like, it's not a choice of his. He literally can't handle it.
So, because we only have a minute left,
yeah.
Applying that to police work,
right.
What is the training and what should the training be for police officers and how to deal with people on the spectrum? And is that kind of the moral of your story?
Absolutely. I mean, I thought Officer Zink was so amazing in the things that he talked about and how you can train police to see that somebody has autism, to not make assumptions and really look at what this person is doing and see the signs. And also, they have a lot more information, I think, as far as how when police go to a house. This person lives in this house. These are this person's triggers. These are the things that can be used as a coping mechanism to help this person calm down. And that's just not something that most police departments have. And I think it would be incredibly beneficial to the autism community and to the police community to have that information available.
This is so important. I'm so glad you did this piece. And you must not only have an important story to tell, you must be very good at telling it, because not everybody gets to sit in for Anna Sale.
No kidding. I mean, you should have seen the flurry of expletives that came out of my mouth when I got that email asking me to do it.
And that's where we'll have to leave it with Diane Gilmorris, who has guest hosted the most recent episode of our Death, Sex, and Money podcast, which you can find by going to WNYC.org or... WNYC.org/death, sex, and money, or wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the last thing that moral philosopher and Princeton professor Peter Singer wants is for his field to limit itself to the academy. He successfully brought the debate about ethical choices to the public, first in 1975, when his book Animal Liberation helped launch a movement that refused to limit the idea of doing the greatest good for the greatest number only to humans. He's continuing that approach to the field with his new book, a collection of his newspaper writing called Ethics in the Real World, 82 brief essays on things that matter. And he covers topics from mercy killing, religious freedom, our obligation to refugees, the poor, future generations, farm animals, and flawed heroes. Oh, and surfing, too. And we'll ask him about ethics in the presidential race later in the segment. But welcome back to WNYC. Peter Singer, hi.
Hi. Thanks, Brian. It's good to be back with you.
The idea of valuing things by the extent to which they offer the greatest benefit to the greatest number is from what I guess you would call the utilitarian school of philosophy. Is that where you would basically situate yourself as an ethicist?
Yes, I'm certainly a utilitarian, and I'm happy to accept that label. But I do want to emphasize that a lot of my writings don't presuppose utilitarianism. Even, for example, my work Animal Liberation nowhere argues for utilitarianism. It simply starts from the idea that pain is a bad thing, suffering is a bad thing. It's better if beings' lives go well, if they're capable of suffering or enjoying their life. And I think most people would accept that, even if they think that there are some other moral rules which might not be compatible with utilitarianism. They can still accept basically the views that I hold on animal issue and many other issues as well.
So I see you're a vegan, for example. Is it because of your own philosophy or more because of health concerns?
No, it's not because of health concerns at all. I mean, you know, it's nice if by being a vegan I am healthier, and I certainly feel very healthy, but that was never a motivation for changing my diet. It was entirely because of my concern about the way animals are treated. And again, let me emphasize, it's the way they're treated. It's not so much the fact that they're killed. Of course, you know, we regret that, and it says something about our attitudes to animals that we're prepared to kill them because we like the taste of their flesh. But if they all led good lives, it would be a much less pressing issue for me. It's the fact that the vast majority of them have miserable lives on factory farms, and that by buying animal products, we're effectively supporting those factory farms and that form of agriculture, which is horrible for the animals and terrible for the environment as well.
How do you reconcile your views on animal rights and what some might see as a decentering of the value of human rights? Is it a zero-sum game, really, where one side, human, or the rest of the animal world has to lose?
No, I don't think it's a zero-sum game, and I'm very concerned about the well-being of humans, and you know, a lot of the other essays in this book, Ethics in the Real World, are about how we can do more to help our fellow humans, and especially those in extreme poverty, how we can be more effective as altruists. The question of rights is a slightly different question. As a utilitarian, my focus is not directly on rights. I certainly think that we ought to recognize people as having a range of rights. The law ought to embody certain rights. But my ethics doesn't start with rights. It starts with the idea of our lives can go well or badly, and that applies to you and me. That applies to people in Malawi or Bangladesh. That also applies to chickens in factory farms. So it starts with the idea that for any being whose life can go well or badly, it's better that their lives go well. And I certainly strongly think that that's very important in humans as well, and I don't think that I would accept that in any way I'm less concerned about that than most other people or other philosophers. I think I'm probably a lot more concerned.
Do you conclude that it's an ethical imperative to seek out controversy? For example, you suggest explaining to everyone at the family Thanksgiving table exactly how awful the lives of the store-bought turkeys that your family is probably about to enjoy really were. I don't know if you get invited to dinner much, but on the, you know, the foundational question there of the ethical imperative to seek out controversy. Do you land there?
I don't seek out controversy for its own sake. I seek out controversy where there are accepted moral views that are causing harm and where the world would be a better place if people changed those views. And the example you mentioned is just one of those. If people would think before they ordered their factory farm turkey for Thanksgiving, am I supporting a system of turkey production that I can really seriously endorse? And if they would take the trouble to learn a few facts about that, as I describe in the essay in Ethics in the Real World, then I think they might change their minds. And there would be fewer turkeys reared in this way, and there would be less suffering in the world, and people could still enjoy their Thanksgiving dinner because there's lots of other great things you can have for Thanksgiving.
In the book, you draw a distinction between the gut moral judgments we make as humans versus the reasoning that the study of ethics requires. And I wonder where you see the limits of reason. One thought experiment you suggest in the book is whether everyone should agree not to have children, since we know global warming is increasing the suffering of future generations. Of course, if nobody living today has children, then I guess humanity would go extinct pretty quickly.
Yeah, and I certainly don't want that. As you say, I raise that question because it's I think it's a question that's worth raising. It's a historical, philosophical question that's been around a long time. There have been pessimists in philosophy like Schopenhauer. So it's worth raising, but I don't reach that conclusion. And in fact, I would be worried if people who are really ethically concerned about the future of the world were to stop having children, because I don't think that would produce a better world in the long run. But to go back to your fundamental question, what's the role of reason in ethics? I don't want to deny that our empathy with others is important and that that is a major ethical motivation for us. But I think we need to have reason, if you like, as a controlling influence on this, because our emotions, our intuitive reactions, our visceral gut feelings can very often lead us astray. And they very often have in the past. You know, people have appealed to them in saying that things like sexual relations between people of the same sex are repugnant. Well, we don't think that anymore, fortunately. Other people, you know, thought that sexual relations between people of different races were repugnant. So, you know, we have to do better than just relying on these intuitions. And very often our reason will tell us, you know, ask, is there any harm here? Who are these people harming? You know, why do I have this feeling about this? Maybe I need to get over that.
My guest is Princeton ethicist Peter Singer. His new book is Ethics in the Real World, 82 Brief Essays on Things That Matter. And after a break, we'll talk about more areas where the needs of the group might take precedence over the needs of you, listeners, as an individual or your children. I'll ask Peter Singer about why, even as a Green Party member, he's decided not to vote for Jill Stein, and why he thinks we need elephant moms, not tiger moms, as he puts it, and the ethics of private tutoring. And we are going to open our phones for you. Do you have an ethical dilemma that you would like help sorting out as pertains to the election, perhaps, or even doing what's best for your own kids? Do you see any conflicts between what's best for your child and what's best for the community of children at large, or anything you want to ask Peter Singer at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Before we go to the break, Professor Singer, I see you're going to be doing an event at Cooper Union tonight, so I'm mentioning that for people who want to go see you at the Great Hall. But I also know that protests have followed you around to some degree in your career. What do you think is the biggest thing that's drawn people out to protest against you?
It's been my views on euthanasia, undoubtedly. It's basically been people, two groups, I could say. People from the Right to Life movement, from the so-called pro-life movement, who've opposed my views about both abortion and aid in dying for people who want to die. But also some people from the disability movement have objected to what I've said, not in favor of ending the lives of infants with severe disabilities, but about giving parents a choice over whether a child that they have with a severe disability should continue to live.
How young and how severe would they have to be by your lights?
Well, I'm talking about decisions that are basically being made while the child is still in hospital in the neonatal intensive care unit. So we're talking about within a month or two of birth. The severity of the disability is a little harder to specify precisely, and that's why I think that if the doctors and parents can get together and agree that it's better for this child that the child should not live, then that's a decision that they ought to be able to make. It's not for someone else to say, you know, even though the parents and the doctors agree that it would be better that this child not live, that the child has to live, and then, you know, be handed back to the parents who have the burden of bringing up a very severely disabled child, possibly with no worthwhile quality of life either.
Has the strong reaction of the disability rights movement affected your views on this over the years?
It has affected my views to some extent, yes. I'm more aware of the fact that sometimes children with very severe disabilities still have excellent qualities of life, and I think that that's clearly a good thing. I also think that when a child is living with a disability or an adult, the state ought to be giving assistance so that it can overcome the social disabilities, that the social difficulties that stand in the way of people with disabilities in living a good life. So I certainly support the disability movement on that question. But in terms of the right to life issue, if you like, which is a more philosophical issue, and the distinction that some people want to draw between withdrawing life support in a neonatal intensive care unit, which actually happens every day in, you know, would happen every day in New York City, I think that there would be an infant in a neonatal intensive care unit where doctors would decide to withdraw life support because of the hopelessness of the prognosis. And the distinction between that and then taking active steps to end the life of a child who perhaps doesn't need life support anymore, is breathing on their own, but still has just as severe a prognosis of not being able to have a worthwhile life. I don't think that there is really a deep distinction between how you bring about the death, whether it's by withdrawing treatment or doing something more active.
And Cecilia in Glen Cove, you're on WNYC with Peter Singer. Hi there.
Hi, good morning. Dr. Singer, my question is about animal rights and veganism. About 20 years ago, I became a vegan primarily through reading your book, Animal Liberation. And in the years to come, especially after I had my children, I've fallen off of the veganism wagon swayed by arguments about needing protein, a difficult pregnancy in which the only thing that I could keep down was were meat products. So, and I've had a dilemma since starting to eat meat, which I try to make sure that it's ethically sourced meat, organic, free range, and so on and so forth. But it's definitely been a dilemma, and I just wonder what you would say to someone like me who's a guilty non-vegetarian at this point.
Professor Singer.
Yeah, look, first I would say, you know, try to get rid of the guilt. I mean, if you had a difficult pregnancy and you couldn't keep anything down except me, that's unfortunate. I think we have to make allowances for the circumstances that people are in. Some people find being vegan easier than others. And I think the thing to do now is to go forward from this point and minimize the harmful impact that your diet and your whole way of living is going to have on animals and on the environment. And that would mean if you feel you can't go back to being completely vegan, it would mean trying to choose the most ethical and most sustainable animal products. So, for example, if you can get free-range eggs, and some supermarkets do now sell genuinely free-range eggs from hens that can range around outdoors, that would be among the animal products where the animals have a decent life and there's not really harmful environmental impact as well. On the other hand, factory farm animal products would be among the worst. And with beef, although, you know, it may be that the animals don't have such a bad life, there is a major greenhouse gas implication to eating beef. So I'd say try and avoid that as well. And, you know, just steer your diet in that direction.
Donald and Cecilia, good luck. Donald in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Donald.
Hi, Brian. And hi, Professor Singer. I have a question. Do you think that Kant was successful in situating a groundwork for morals and moral action within a rational will?
I'm not a Kantian, so my answer to that is no. I don't think the philosophical arguments that Kant put forward really hold up. But I do think that reason has an important role to play in ethics. So in a sense, over my career, and I write about this in Ethics in the Real World in a book called, in an essay called Does Anything Really Matter, I think it's called, I now think that reason plays a larger role in ethics than I did when I was younger. So you could say I'm shifting a little bit in the Kantian direction.
Adina in Fairlawn, you're on WNYC with Peter Singer. Hi, Adina.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
So I have a question about the ethics of suicide. I know that this is a very hard topic for most people to talk about, and I think that that's the reason why we should talk about it. So my question is, when someone wants to commit suicide, when they're thinking about ending their life, people immediately try to help them stay alive, to convince them in any way possible to stay alive. When someone commits suicide, everyone is very sad and disturbed by it. It seems that even though there are people that they're very logical people, they tried everything that they possibly can to make their life better, but sometimes there's just no way for them to live a good life.
And Adina, I'm gonna leave it there and get an answer because we're coming toward the end of the show. Professor Singer, I presume you've thought a lot about suicide.
I have definitely. It's a very emotive term, but in fact, people have all sorts of reasons for choosing to end their life. And you know, California recently legalized physician assistance in dying, as Oregon and Washington and Vermont have done. There's a sense in which those people are committing suicide. The movement for the assistance in dying doesn't like to use that word. But, you know, they're choosing to end their lives now rather than to let an illness that's going to cause suffering and poor quality of life.
But let me follow up. I presume, and we just have 45 seconds or so, but real world ethics would demand, I imagine, that you ascertain that certain conditions apply, meet certain kinds of standards before you would not do everything you could to intervene to stop somebody from killing themselves, right?
Absolutely, because I think there are rational bases where people might decide to end their life, and on that basis, in those cases, you shouldn't stop them. That might be a minority of cases, but there certainly are such cases.
And if we had more time, we might go through what some of the standards might be in that area. But Peter Singer, thanks for coming on with us.
Thank you very much, Brian. It's been my pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.